Station number 14983, Albert Shippen, Reel 18, the last.
Mr. Shippen, Reel 18. You were talking about the fact that you were discharged during your illness, Mr. Shippen. Can you go on with that?
Yes. And as I say, I joined the army as a profession. And after being in the hospital for the six-month period, which when I was whitelisted from a unit, that I was medically discharged. And I was, I received a disability pension at that time. I was then transferred from the military hospital to the National Health Hospital in Walsingham to finish off my treatment and that there. And I was no longer a soldier. So one day they arrived and wanted to collect me the kit off me, which was I thought was rather preposterous when you're lying in bed there ill, and probably the illness that they had was probably through to military activity and being a bugle major and so forth and that. So yes, I took a dim view as far as that was concerned. I didn't think the army had carried out its obligations. And more so today, when I hear that people, girls that become pregnant, are given these fantastic sums of money. I didn't enjoy my illness. I'm supposed they enjoyed their pregnancy. So
how long were you in the hospital altogether?
Well, the first time, I would think, from going into Berlin to getting discharged from Walsingham, I would think about a year, just over a year. And of course, the thing then was rehabilitation. And then, of course, I'd been in the army since I was 14, so it was a shock to the system beyond belief. I didn't know what people did in civilian life. I had to start and think of getting a job and a house and something entirely new. I hadn't been in that position before in my life, and so it was all a bit of a upping struggle as far as I was concerned.
What date would this be?
Well, this was 1952, beginning of 1952. And then, of course, when I was discharged from Walsingham,
which would be a year later.
Yes, I was then had to go to Newcastle, to St. Mary's Place, to go in front of medical boards, because I was receiving the war, what wasn't a war pension, but they called it the war pensions, from Norcross in Blackpool. And that was a bit degrading. You went in front of three doctors and they said, "How are you getting on?" and all the rest, this kind of thing. And so forth and that. And then about, I don't know, say a month later, you got a letter saying that you're no longer 100% disabled. Your pension was being cut, and this went on. And then after a period of something like about, I think it was about 3 or 4 years, I ended up from being 100% disabled to being given a final payment of, I think it was something like about 100 and something pound, of which £50 was deducted, which had been given to me when I was discharged to help me to for resettlement. So I rather took a dim view of that part of the army, because I didn't think that it was quite justifiable what they did to me. But I was that determined that I was going to succeed, and because of what I'd learned in the army, I was going to succeed in civilian life regardless. But then again, we come back to this theme that the regiment looks after its own. And one day I was in Durham City when I met Colonel Lowe, who was the regimental secretary at the time, and said to me, "How was I getting on? Did I want any money, or was there anything that could help me out with in this kind?" Which was a good thing, regimentally, in this kind of thing. And I said, "No, but I'd love a job," because just before then, I'd reported, obviously, to the employment exchange, being unemployed, and they said, "All right, well," they sent me off. I lived in Brandon, and they sent me off to a government training centre in Felling, after being in hospital in all the trials and tribulations. And it was very bad weather. It was the winter and everything. And one evening I was getting off the bus at Meadowfield, and the doctor, the local doctor, said, "Hello, how are you?" And I said, "Fine." He said, "What do you do now, days like this?" And I said, I get up in the morning at something like about 7 o'clock, and I travel to Felling, which is about 30 miles away in those days. It was, I had to go by bus. I says, "And I'm learning to be a draftsman." And he says, "How long has this been going on?" And I said, "A few weeks now." He said, "Well, I've got news to you. You've been for the last time. You come to my surgery tomorrow and I'll give you a letter. You're not going back there travelling up and forth in this weather under your conditions." So I went back to see the doctor, and he stopped me from going, being trained anymore in this. And I became unemployed. And then I met Colonel Law, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I told him that. And he said, "Right, Monday morning, you go up to the 8th Battalion Down Light Infantry, see the adjutant, Captain Peart, and," he says, "and tell him you're the new storeman." So the regiment had sorted me out a job. Interviewed in the Silver Street in the middle of Durham. So I went up there, and of course, there again, the family regiment rallied round and looked after me, and gave me a civilian employment job, which was ideal because I had to go back to full health and this kind of thing. So after I'd been there for a while, somebody decided I should join the Territorial Army, to which I remarked that I was unable to, because during that period the Durham Light Infantry had raised the 2nd Battalion, one of the few regiments that was asked to raise the 2nd Battalion of Infantry. And that was formed and went out to Wuppertal. The commanding officer at the time was a chap called Marky Leather. And he wrote to me and asked me if I'd like to join the army again and become the bugle major of the 2nd Battalion. To which I went through certain medicals and that, and I was classified, something I think, if my memory serves right, in those days, on the Pullum scheme as P7, which meant United Kingdom only. And so that wasn't going to be advantageous to anybody. They could have fiddled me to get into BOR and this kind of thing, but I said, no way, I'm not going to go back and soldier on in the United Kingdom for the rest of my life. And this kind of thing didn't appeal to me. And as I say, I'd started to look for better wages, more civilianised. So after I'd worked at the TA for a few years, someone suggested I joined the TA. And I remember they said, yes, we can get you in the TA. So I went for my medical this night, and they called the medical officer, Major Watson, who'd been throughout the war with the 8th Battalion. And he stood in front of this coal fire in the drill hall, leaning on the mantel shelf, and he said, ah, and how are you tonight? I says, I'm fine, sir. He says, two arms, two legs, two ears, two eyes, nose and the mouth, you're in. So that was my medical to join the TA.
What date was this?
Well, that would be about 1955, when I joined the 8th Battalion. And I was promoted to sergeant immediately, and I was with the 8th Battalion as a civilian and as a sergeant. And then I thought, well, it's time for the goal. It's time to move on. I'm not going to get anywhere in this employment.
Did this mean that basically you were unemployed but just doing Territorial Army drills and so forth? Were you a full-time paid soldier with the Terriers?
No, I was...
Just the same as any other Territorial?
I was just a Territorial, but I was a civilian employed by the Territorials full-time. I worked full-time for the Territorial Association as a storeman. And so I said, well, it's time to move on. Are you going to make anything out of life? So I went, and I took up a storeman's job at an agricultural and automobile engineering firm out of Croxdale. And there I stayed for a while. All the time, going to progress, I hope, as I learned the trade and how civilian life worked. So from then I moved to Newton Aycliffe, to a factory in Newton Aycliffe, which was called Crane Boilers. At that time, North Sea Gas had just come in, and they were converting a lot of gas appliances from coal gas to this North Sea gas. And a lot of redundant miners had been brought in, the semi-skilled workers, into these conversions in at this factory in Newton Aycliffe. So I was dispatch manager there, in charge of the stores and dispatch manager. And I was offered a job down at their main factory down in Norwich, but my wife declined to go, so I stayed with them. Then I was asked to go as the agricultural stores manager to Young's Motors in Chessy Street, Ford. I went across, I left Crane Boilers and went to manage the stores and that for Young's Motors in Chessy Street. I won a couple of awards from Ford Motor Company. I got a holiday in Spain, going down on from Southampton to Bilbao on a luxury liner, and spending a few days in San Sebastian and then coming back on a luxury liner. I was awarded the Outstanding Manager of the Year with a Ford tractor section of the Ford company, and I didn't feel as though that company again was going to give me any great satisfaction in the end as far as promotion and that was concerned. So I applied for a job with a company called Scottish Land Development, owned by a chap called Neil Hodge, and it was just a brand new company starting off in a kind of a service industry which I'd never heard about in my life. And these were where you hide in tools scrapers and bulldozers and equipment and so forth. But they were starting a new section which had in pumps. I'd never seen a pump in my life. I knew what it was about. Anyway, I went for an interview in front of the directors and was given the job. And that intrigued me because the first stores we had was two old railway wagons. That's what we started with. Later, about 6 months after I'd been with this company, the law were expanding at a very fast rate of knots. We were one of the first companies in the United Kingdom to go onto this pump hire solely because the North Sea oil was coming in, the mines were being expanded, and we were hiring out these pumps and selling these pumps, and somebody had seen a niche in the market, and it was going on at a very fast rate of knots. Anyway, along came a very enterprising entrepreneur by the name of James Hansen, and thought the company looked good and decided to purchase it off Neil Hodge. And in the company we were at that time, we had three sections. We had the sales and service division, and we had the mechanical handling division, and we had the pump division. And he'd had us for about 3 months or somebody called us all together and said that the pump company going to remain in Hansen Trust, as it was known as in those days, they were going to sell off the mechanical handling division to another construction company, and the sales and service division was going to be amalgamated with a company called Volvo BMC, which was the big Volvo earth scrapers and everything like that. Now, if you consider this, he bought the whole of that company for £666,000 from Neil Hodge, and he sold one third of it to a company called Uden Stewart for £2 million. He still owned us, and he still owned the sales and service, which had gone into BMC, Volvo BMC. Anyway, it was a good thing for us because with the money he got, he expanded us at a very fast rate of knots. We had about 12 depots throughout the four northern counties in Scotland and Ireland within about a year. Anyway, our agreement with another company who would, was in Pumbaa was called Henry Sykes. And we couldn't go below what we called the Mason-Dixon line, for the give it a name, which was from Barrow and Furness across to Whitby. But Hansen, who was an entrepreneur, said that's no good. So we broke our agreement with him, and we went through those that line into the south. And within about 3 year, we had about 42 depots throughout the United Kingdom. In my job, I was a supplies and purchasing officer by then. I was responsible for all the purchasing of the pumps, auxiliary equipment, spare parts, and motor vehicles and this kind of thing. And it got quite a prominent position. And at the same time, the parent company, which was Hansen Trust at that time, had grown alongside us as we'd grown. And we moved into Australia, sent men out to Australia after training, as far as we were concerned. And a lot of the entrepreneurs and the people, the accountants, and that who were going to form this huge conglomerate in years to come came for training to the pump company which I was with, which was just then known as SLD. Didn't mean anything, but it was Scottish Land Development, so we'd sold the Scottish Land Development off to Ewart and Stewart, so we just kept the letters SLD, which didn't mean anything to anybody, but of course people related that to us.
And did you retain this position till you retired?
Oh yes, yes, yes. Yes, I got, although I retained the same name as the supplies and purchasing manager, I got a couple of promotions from being of managerial status to being on what is commonly known as the operational board of the company, although I wasn't a director. On the board of the company, there were six directors, that included the managing director. There was three operational managers. They controlled the operations within the three regions that we had. There was one electrical manager who was responsible for all electrical equipment and health and safety and that. And I was the other member of the team, of which there was 11 of us. We ran the company, made the company policy, and did the budgets, and any new ventures and that was, we were taken on was I was involved in, particularly on the purchasing side, and also assessing suppliers of how fast they could respond to our requests, and to find out what new equipment was available. I went on, mostly my dealings were within Europe, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, Austria, Germany, and Holland.
When did you retire?
Retired 2 years ago, so that would be 1992.
What was your final position with the Turriers?
Oh, well, I finished up as the RQMS of which eventually was the 7th Battalion Light Infantry, but when the Territorial Army was reformed in 1967, each battalion, in fact the Dermite Infantry had two battalions, the 6th and the 8th, and we made up one light infantry company, which went we came under the command down in Shrewsbury of the Light Infantry Volunteers, and then the 6th and the 8th made one battalion, but it was a home service battalion and it didn't last no longer than about a year. Then I went off to because I was getting a bit long in the tooth, and there was that many warrant officers and officers and that places couldn't be found for in the new organisation done by General Carver, should have been made the butcher, that we were only given a period of time of about 2 years or more. Anyway, in that time I was approached by Colonel Baker Cresswell, who had taken over the Northumberland Volunteers, and he asked me to join the Northumberland Volunteers as an RQMS. So I went off to the Northumberland Volunteers and I served under Baker Cresswell. I served under Mike McBain as the Colonel and John Spedding as the Colonel, and then in 77, would you believe, the year when we had all the Green Goddesses packed up in all the TA centres and that I was dined out at Eben Drill Hall. It was the only drill hall that was available at the time.
So when you were finished with the TA officially, when did that happen?
In 1977.
Oh, that was the end of your career.
Yeah, but from then, of course, I've always been involved in military regimental activities. I was secretary of the 1st and 2nd Battalion WOs and Sergeants Dinner Club. That's people that were regular soldiers and that. And I did that for about 16 years. And then about 4 years ago, I was the first non-commissioned officer to take over the presidency of the WOs and Sergeants Dinner Club. I'm also chairman of the Faithful Dinner Club, and that mostly involves people who are not active in the DLI association and live outside the county area, who are still interested in the activities of the regiment. We've got lieutenant colonels and majors and captains and ex-warrant officers from the Territorial Army, cadet forces, and the regular army who are members of this. I think we've got something like about 160 members at the moment and growing, because we're now involving the young lads that's coming out of the light infantry into the situation. And about 2 months ago, the 8th and 11th Battalion have an old comrades association, and the chap who's run it for years and years, Jimmy Mullall, he's retired. And to keep it going and continuing on in the same vein, we come to the agreement, George Fraser and I, that George would take over the secretary and I would take over the treasurer to keep this organisation going. So the latest episode I've done, we've raised over £1,000 to have the memorial stones in the Cathedral Remembrance Garden in Durham replaced. And at this moment of time, we're our exercises, we found an unmarked grave belonging to Private Kennan, who won his VC in 1915 in the Durham Light Infantry. So now we're going to put a headstone up to mark his grave in the cemetery at Wheatley Hill. And this very morning, we've just been told that one of the ex-members of the regiment, George Self, his wife decided to hand in a DCM, his DCM, to the Radio Milton Museum in Durham City. So we're now organising that to be presented at 2 o'clock on Friday afternoon. So we're full of activity and the Durhams are still marching on.